I think in the next 5 years, there are going to be a lot of people who have to make a payment with stablecoin who are going to say, I don't want to do this. Transfer like I always do. And they're going to not know what this is. They're going to not know how to do it, not understand how it works, and they're not going to trust it. And if they have access to that through a bank that they already trust, and that bank is there to say, hey, we're ahead of you on this. We've got it ready to go. We'll walk you through it. We can help you adjust to this new future payment system that can actually strengthen a customer's relationship with their bank.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Elizabeth Holtrup, and today I am very pleased to be joined by one of my own coworkers here at Compliance Alliance within the Hub, Jessica Lamoureux. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Happy to be here.
I'm so glad that you took some time to spend with us. I'm going to start with a short bio so everyone can get to know Jessica if listeners don't already know her. And then we are going to do a dive into some of the emerging proposed rules surrounding stablecoin, especially in light of the Genius Act and kind of how banks are looking at proceeding when it comes to specific rules. So Jessica Lamoureux is a JD in CRCM as well as the Director of Education at Compliance Alliance. She earned her law degree magna cum laude from Case Western Reserve, where she was a law review editor, and holds a political science degree from Kenyon College. Licensed in Ohio, Jessica has worked in bankruptcy court, a debt collection law firm, a consumer lender, and as director of risk and compliance at an SaaS startup. Her work focuses on compliance training and policy drafting. She's a featured author and frequent speaker on regulatory issues. And now she is a podcast guest, and we're very pleased to have you here. So Jessica, any opening words you want to give us about stablecoin, the Genius Act, or, you know, just summarize this huge piece of legislation and the emerging rules and, you know, just a few brief sentences. If there's anything you'd like to say to start, feel free. Otherwise, I've got some questions I would specifically like to go over.
It's such a big topic at this point. Yep. I feel like it snuck up on us, right?
Yeah.
Like this was something out in the periphery. And then there was talk about, oh, it might be a real thing. Oh, they might regulate it. And now it's like, boom, here it is. It's real time. And now maybe when we thought this isn't worth paying attention to, it isn't a priority. Now all of a sudden we feel like we're trying to play catch up and understand what this is. And now learn about this regulatory framework that is being built in real time in front of our eyes. Right. So I think a lot of bankers feel overwhelmed by this right now. And it's not, when you get into it, it's not as bad as it seems from the outside. But that
I love that you said that.
But that doesn't mean that you don't have to pay some attention, right? Like we are going to have to learn about this and it's going to take a little bit of work.
Well, I'm excited that as our director of education, you are going to help us learn because we all need a little bit of helping and instruction. To start off, can you give us just a brief overview of the proposed rules? We've had drops from the OCC, FDIC, Treasury. There's some similar guidance, but there is some differences as well. And can you just talk about specifically how some of that is going to affect banks?
Right. So there are actually four proposed rules right now from three different agencies. So the FDIC came out and they were first out the gate. They proposed their rule about what the application process would be. For any bank that is interested in being an issuer in potentially, it's unlikely that a smaller bank would want to be an issuer independently, but I have heard some talk about smaller banks potentially forming some sort of consortium, right? That would create an issuer subsidiary. So any bank that is interested in becoming an issuer should be paying attention to what their regulator is doing in terms of regulating this application process. obviously mm-hmm. that's an important thing. But if you aren't mm-hmm. going to be filing one of these applications, this proposed FDIC rule about the application process is unlikely to be relevant to you directly.
Yep.
The OCC then came out with their big bill, right? Or big, it wasn't the big bill. The big bill was a different thing. It was their big regulatory proposal. And
it was hundreds of pages. Yeah. It was not OCC as many hundreds as you do in fact, but it was hundreds of pages. Yeah.
Yes. The OCC said, okay, FDIC, I see your application process and raise you.
Here's looking at you.
15 different other sections or whatever it is. So they are talking about not just how you're going to apply to become an issuer and get licensed, but how you're going to operate, what the rules would be for the assets backing the stable coin, all those sorts of things that will, again, only be relevant to banks that are interested in being issuers, right?
Yep.
They also have rules for non-bank entities. So there are rules for non-banks that want to be issuers, rules for banks that would be, or any kind of issuer that would be licensed by their state and what would apply to them in certain situations. They have changes to supervisory assessments that are unlikely to affect banks that aren't acting as issuers. But then there's a section that they do have about custody services, custody and safekeeping. And that's the thing that I think eventually in the long term is going to be relevant to a lot of institutions. If these assets, as predicted, become fairly ubiquitous, we may need to be looking at those rules specifically and the expectations there.
So that's a really good distinction. Can I make sure I understand that difference? So a lot of banks, especially smaller community banks, are not necessarily going to want to be issuing stablecoins. Now, they might as a consortium deal, but probably not individually issuing stablecoins. But they might, as this becomes more of an industry standard, be custody keepers because potentially stablecoins are going to might become part of a normal consumer's deposit portfolio. Is that how I'm understanding that distinction?
Yes, but there's another piece to it too.
Okay.
So stable coins are required to be backed on a one-to-one basis, right?
Yes, they are. Indeed.
By an asset reserve. And one permissible asset that you can use to back your stable coin is a deposit at an FDIC insured institution. And that's another type of custody service that banks potentially provide is custody of that asset reserve.
And the asset reserve has to be a different asset than a stable coin. Like we're often talking, it's going to be a US dollar. Is that fair to say?
Right. So the way that it works is for every stable coin that you issue as an issuer, you have to have $1 of some highly stable liquid asset sitting behind you that backs that stable coin.
Yep. As in you can't back stable coins with other stable coins. They have to be backed.
And you can't back them with crypto. You can't back them with gold. You can't back them. There's a very limited set of assets, but one of them is FDIC insured. Well, deposits at FDIC insured institutions. And then for exceptionally large issuers, the OCC is also looking at imposing a requirement that a certain amount of their asset reserve actually be an FDIC insured deposit, meaning that they would have to have a certain amount of money that would be set up through essentially like brokered deposits through potentially thousands of banks to make sure that FDIC insurance applied. So banks that are not interested in being issuers may have opportunities to provide custody services that they would be doing pursuant to this, if they're an OCC supervised bank, this proposed rule from the OCC, or the FDIC then came later and proposed added their second proposed rule that includes requirements for custody services for FDIC supervised banks.
So the upshot is, there's opportunity for financial institutions of various sizes and complexity to get involved. The flip side of that is involvement is going to require following these precise rules.
It is. Fortunately, if you look at the rules for custody services, these are not sort of box checking exercises.
Okay.
These are more in the vein of what we see with like BSA, that okay. you need to have risk-based procedures that achieve certain goals.
Okay.
That's so fair it to isn't say. As rigid as perhaps like the OCC's asset diversification requirements.
Okay. Along those same lines, there are some broad requirements that are written entirely into the Genius Act, and some things like those asset reserves are, certain of those rules are written entirely into the actual legislation that was passed by Congress. Mm-hmm. But now what we're seeing is the agencies, who are, of course, usually given fairly broad range to implement regulations once there's any piece of legislation that passes, the agencies are grappling with what they're going to require depending on their regulatory scope, all that good stuff. What are some of the similarities and differences you're seeing from the proposed frameworks coming out from the different agencies?
As far as the custody services, the FDIC and the OCC seem to be very closely aligned.
Super. That makes things easier, I think. You know, when banks are looking, they're going to be looking at their regulatory agency, but that means training, analysis, that type of stuff is probably going to apply equally to different regulated banks, hopefully.
Right. Absolutely. As far as requirements for issuers, there mm-hmm. are some points where the OCC and the FDIC definitely have diverged in their okay. proposals. And I think that's sort of interesting. It's a little bit controversial, actually, because the Genius Act does instruct the agencies to work together to try mm-hmm. to come up with a coherent framework across the whole spectrum of different regulators that are involved in this. But they're all making rules. They're all drafting these proposals at the same time without knowing what the other agencies are going to come out with. So now we see the OCC came out with its proposal and the FDIC came out with theirs. The OCC has pretty rigid asset diversification requirements. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the FDIC's rule didn't. So are we going to yep. see them? Are they going to meet and have, like, let's hash it out and come up with a compromise mm-hmm. that we can be okay with to make it very consistent mm-hmm. across different regulators? I don't know. Additionally, there's also the FDIC rule specifically required that if an issuer issues multiple different brands of stablecoins, this is what they're envisioning, that they'll issue essentially a lot of white labeled stablecoins that'll go out. So company A will have its own, company B will have its own, but they'll all be from the same issuer. And one
That's
of the-
interesting. So they might be branded separately, but we're kind of anticipating they might be from the same issuer. Okay, interesting.
And one of the questions is, if all of these coins, A, B, and C, are coming from the same issuer, is there one asset reserve behind all those coins? Or is there a distinct asset reserve that has to be separately managed? And the OCC was agnostic on this question okay. in their proposal. They actually said, we aren't sure and we're interested in feedback about it because we okay. haven't really made a decision. And the FDIC said, we are thinking separate reserves.
Do you think the FDIC, I know you can't read their minds. I wish you could, Jessica. Do you think they said separate reserves because the record keeping would be so much easier? And easier for examiners to find that one-on-one or one-to-one backing? Or do you think that they have some other reason why they're leaning towards separate reserves?
I think one of the big concerns would be if there was what they call a depegging event or a flaw mm-hmm. in the management of a reserve. Yep. Yep. You wouldn't want that contagion to spread, mm-hmm. especially yep. if it happened with a very large issuer that maybe mm-hmm. was very dominant in the market, mm-hmm. something goes yeah. wrong, something gets wonky in one asset reserve. You don't want mm-hmm. that to sort of cast doubt on the
kind
stability.
Of a too big to fail potential situation. Diversification right. provides stability. Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. I was going to ask, what are some of the biggest takeaways you're seeing from these proposed rules? I feel like we've already kind of touched on that. specifically as it relates to community banks looking at handling stablecoins, I think you've kind of laid out that potentially some of that custody might be where smaller or community banks can get involved the most easily. Do you know at all any of the specifics that some of banks are looking at in terms of consortia, or is that really just something that innovation programs and alliance allied banks are really kind of developing on their side while we reasonably focus more on like analysis of the rules coming out?
I haven't heard, I'm not party to those discussions. I've been led to believe that those discussions are happening at some banks, but I couldn't say for certain. I don't know. One thing I would say is it does seem to me, this sort of reminds me of maybe, I don't know if I'm, you know, giving myself away here, but I do remember a time when we didn't have P2P apps.
I also, strangely, because you and I are both very young, Jessica, but I also remember those times.
And I remember when I had to adopt a P2P app to split an expense with somebody for something. And I thought, this is a nuisance. Why do I have to do this? I don't want to do it. I want to write you a check like I would have done a year ago and be done with it, right? And I imagine that I wasn't the only person that felt that way. And I think in the next 5 years, there are going to be a lot of people who have to make a payment with stablecoin who are going to say, I don't want to do this. I want to send you a P2P transfer like I always do.
A P2P transfer in US dollars, just like the old school way we always did it.
Right. And they're going to not know what this is. They're going to not know how to do it, not understand how it works, and they're not going to trust it. And if they have access to that through a bank that they already trust, and that bank is there to say, hey, we're ahead of you on this. We've got it ready to go. You know us. We can walk you through it. We can help you adjust to this new future payment system. That can actually strengthen a customer's relationship with their bank. My bank is there for me to help me with this strange new world, right? And I think I know that there are a lot of ways that banks are worried about what stablecoin is going to mean for their future. But just like you don't want to deal with stablecoin, your customers probably don't either, but they're going to have to. And if you can help them, that's going to be a benefit to your bank and to your customer relationships.
I think that is such a good point. And as our director of education here at Compliance Alliance, obviously you're education minded, but I always like to make the link to the fact that community banks educate their communities. They play a huge role in terms of financial literacy. Like you said, giving peace of mind to local account holders who trust their banker. Maybe they literally have worked with the same human being who's a banker down at their community bank, or at least they trust that brick building down on Main Street. So if community banks can, at the very least, find a role where they are providing some basic services and providing that peace of mind and education to their customers about how to adopt, how to get on board, what I'm hearing from you is that is a way they could potentially carve out a little piece of the market. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I think that there is a potential opportunity there. And I think that a lot of people aren't going to be jumping into this with both feet. They're going to be dragged kicking and screaming into it the way that we've been dragged kicking and screaming into all the technological changes that have happened over the course of our lives, right? And to be there, to be able to support your customers while they have their tantrums is one of the functions of a community bank, right?
Yeah. I do think that what I am seeing from bankers is a lot of concern and trepidation. Banks are traditionally traditional, which means they don't love adopting new things. But also in the work both you and I do working with banks across the nation, I think it's fair to say that we see a lot of openness and excitement, just some unsure lack of clarity on how to get involved safely, effectively, and what that's going to mean operation-wise, all that stuff. So I do think paying attention to the rules as they're emerging, especially when we're in some of these proposal stages where banks can actually offer comments, like they can help shape some of this. It's a beautiful, exciting time to get more involved rather than pulling back and waiting. In terms of the proposals we're seeing, especially in terms of comment periods, that type of thing, what timelines do you think banks can expect for like the final rulemaking? And what other considerations should banks be thinking about in terms of shifting factors, emerging compliance issues? There's a lot up in the air. When are we going to see some stuff land and start to be rooted and grounded?
Well, I don't think they're going to let any moss grow.
I agree. On this.
They're going to move quickly.
We've seen very quick movement. Yep.
Part of that is actually driven by the way that the Genius Act was drafted.
Yep.
So it's early January of 2027 is a drop dead date. Mm-hmm. The statute becomes effective on that date, whether the rules are made or not.
So we're really hoping for some rules. Yes.
So that means that the regulators absolutely have, I mean, technically they don't absolutely have to, but I think from their perspective, their view would be that they really have to get some rules in place before January of 2027. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely necessary. The statute directs them to get the rules in place by July of this year. And then that January deadline is like a backstop. So even if you don't do what we told you, it goes live 6 months later anyway.
Yep.
So they're shooting for that July deadline. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the earlier proposals, especially like the FDIC's pretty bare bones rule about the just what the application process is going to be. I wouldn't be surprised to see that finalized before that July deadline, just to try to keep up with what the statute was asking for. But the other proposed rules, they might not be finalized. I think they're going to get quite a bit of comments on some of the provisions there. They might have a lot to go through, but they really are going to be burning the midnight oil to make sure that they get something in place before January.
Yeah, I think it is such a short timeline. To some of us, several months seems like there's enough of a scope to get something done. But the breadth of the rules we're looking at here, and truly just the time it takes for thoughtful, experienced professionals to get their head around the best way to implement some of this stuff, I do not think this is a long timeline for some of these agencies to work with. I'm also struck when you're talking about that July deadline, because correct me if my memory is wrong, but I think at least one of these rules had a comment period that went up through June of this year. So June comments close. I agree with you that July would be ideal, but I just can't imagine getting through that many comments and drafting a final rule to drop 1 month later in July.
Well, and usually most rules will have a 30-day, at least a 30-day period before they become effective.
Exactly. Yep.
But so Treasury's rule is the, I think Treasury's rule definitely has a comment period that goes into June. And the FDIC's second rule, the larger, the more complex of their proposals, may also go into June. So I would be very surprised if they were able to get through all that and get a final version done by July. But I think they're going to do what they have to get something in place by January.
I think so, too. I think from a practical level, what that means for bankers is keeping your ear to the ground, watching what's developing. Because when proposals and final rules do drop, they're going to be probably implemented quickly. They're going to take effect with banks probably in a quicker way than we might imagine certain other rules and we might be used to with pacing in terms of regulation and banking changes. We're talking about all these proposals, and we've seen proposed rules from the OCC, FDIC, and Treasury. So what's up with the Fed? Any thoughts on that?
Who knows? The Fed has been pretty quiet, not because it doesn't have anything to do, right?
Oh, no. The Fed has nothing to do with stablecoin. I am being sarcastic. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So I think, as I said earlier, the Fed is, all the agencies are sort of directed by the Genius Act to come up with a comprehensive framework, right?
Yep.
Like, how are you going to do all of this? How is it going to work across these different regulators, banks supervised by different regulators? I think the Fed might be kind of waiting. Like, let's see what the OCC and the FDIC come out with. And then
we're
going to just
harder,
be like,
harder. What they said. Someone wrote a memo and said, hey, if they can get some drafts out, why would we retype it?
Right. Because I think the Fed might be thinking that it can't really know what it wants its rule to be until it knows what the rules are that it wants to align with. Right.
That's fair. No, that's truly fair. And that might prove very, very helpful for banks, especially Fed regulated banks, if the Fed's final rules end up being closer in alignment than if they had all dropped proposals that weren't really quite meshing with each other. That's fair.
I mean, we should see a rule from the Fed. It's definitely directed. And I would be very surprised if they were just going to blow through these deadlines and not air. Yeah. But they've been quiet so far. And we don't know. It could be that these agencies are meeting, right? And working together, looking at comments that are received on both the proposals that are currently out there. There may be more coordination than we're aware of.
I love the thought that there may be more coordination than we're aware of. I'm going to help make that sleep. That'll make me sleep better at night. I want to shift gears into something a little bit more specific. And I know we're coming to the end of our time. But there is a lot of discussion within the banking community about the yield prohibition and the risk of disintermediation. Can you give us a little more information on what that concern is? Maybe define some of those terms for those of us who haven't had our second cup of coffee yet today. How is that addressed in the Genius Act itself or in the proposed rules we have now?
Right. So the concern is basically if consumers start hold consumers, small businesses, regular bank customers start holding a portion of their assets as stablecoin, they won't be holding those assets as deposits at a bank. And the bank won't have that in their deposit base, right?
I think banks are quite concerned that essentially their deposits might be drained unless they can get on board and figure out how they're going to be part of custody keeping and all that. Banks do not want to be losing deposits, especially right now. I agree.
Right. So that's called disintermediation, when somebody's getting between the bank and its customers and providing some service that would have been normally provided by the bank. That's disintermediation. The yield prohibition is premised on the idea that one of the things that keeps deposits at a bank is the fact that a deposit at a bank pays a yield.
Yeah, we get interest on our deposits. I love my high yield savings.
So they wrote into the Genius Act a prohibition because stablecoin, it's in the name, it's not just called stablecoin, it's called payment stablecoin.
Yeah.
Because it's intended to be used for payments, right? So as a payment mechanism. As a payment mechanism, it isn't necessarily going to threaten deposits. It's not a savings mechanism. It's a payment mechanism. So what the yield prohibition does is it said stablecoin holders can't pay interest or a yield on stablecoins. Basically, we don't want them to operate like deposits, and we don't want to incentivize people into moving their deposits out of banks. So the regulations have to enact that prohibition. They have to figure out exactly what the words are going to be, how you're going to frame it, where the line is going to be as to this is a yield, this is something that's functioning like interest, or it's not. There's been a lot of debate, for example, about things that are labeled as rewards programs. Both the FDIC and the OCC have written the yield prohibition into their regulation and exactly the same what they've written. It says you can't pay a yield, well, a holder can't pay a yield solely based on the use, holding, a couple other different verbs of a stable coin. And then it creates this rebuttable presumption of a certain specific situation that it would, there would be a rebuttable presumption that this is a prohibited yield or prohibited interest payment.
Okay.
And the presumption is essentially if the stablecoin holder is paying a yield to a third party or an affiliate, and that third party or the affiliate is then paying that to the end user. And the third party or affiliate is the white labeler of the issuer's stablecoin. So that would raise the presumption.
Okay. I
would argue that that's a fairly high bar, that there's, do we really need to have the white labeler relationship to call that a yield? Maybe if you're paying a third party and that third party's paying holders of your stablecoin, is that enough to say that a yield's being paid? This is why we comment. This is why it's important for banks to take a look at these rules and participate in commenting and contact your regulator and say, I'm not sure this is robust enough. I think that maybe this should be a clearer line. There should be more instances where we're going to say this looks pretty fishy.
Yeah. No, I'm so happy you laid that out and laid it out in kind of the technical way that the rules and the Genius Act are intersecting. Because anyone who's been paying attention to like their email blasts has been seeing state bankers associations, Texas Bankers Association, for example, has been very vocal about that, getting bankers involved to talk to their congresspeople about the fact that technically you're not supposed to pay a yield on a stablecoin, but this could be a loophole through which essentially possibly end users like a consumer is getting a yield on a stablecoin. If the end user consumer is basically getting a yield on a stablecoin, they are not incentivized to keep their US dollars deposit with their bank, and then banks lose out. So talk to your Congress people, talk to the comment box. It is, we have a comment period here. Like there's a space for our voices right now.
But the other thing is, I just want to throw out there the converse side of that is the easier it is for a consumer to convert their dollars to stablecoin at their bank and use that stablecoin for whatever payment needs they have, and that the extent to which their bank is able to make that frictionless for them, the less they're going to feel the need to, I got to just keep some stablecoin locked away because it's a big pain when I have to convert it. Right. So there is some incentive there for banks to make it accessible to their customers.
So let's say I have my US dollar savings account. I got my nice high yield rate. I have it at my Main Street Community Bank, and I want to take a portion out of my savings to pay for something. We're looking at a future where payment stablecoin could be used to do anything from, you know, buy a hamburger to buy a car, is my understanding. So let's say I'm taking a chunk out of savings to buy a new car. If I can very quickly move that, like maybe I used to go and ask for a cashier's check and take that cashier's check down to the car dealership. Instead, if I can just move a chunk out of my US dollar savings account, move that chunk over into payment stablecoin and buy my consumer goods, I don't have to suddenly say, I want that whole savings account to be in payment stablecoin because I, you know, I'm not quite sure if I can access my funds and flow it quickly once I find that car and I don't want to lose that car deal. Is that a fair way of summarizing how banks can make things very easy so they incentivize me to keep my savings in US dollars, FDIC insured at the local bank if I can very quickly then pull what I need, get it into payment stablecoin and flow that transaction the same way we would consider a P2P or a debit card or something like that these in our current framework of banking?
I sort of feel, I know that there is an impulse to say, I don't want to make it easier for a customer to move their money out. I know and I feel that, but I'm not sure it's really necessarily true. So I think that that might be that making it easier makes consumers less reluctant to keep their money where it is now if they know it's easy to do whatever they want with it when the time comes.
I think that's such a good point. And honestly, banks love deposits. I mean, it's a core part of banking. But banks, at the end of the day, they want to help consumers use their money and use it in safe, effective ways. The whole point is it is my money on deposit. I need to be able to access it. So I think that is such a good point that the easier a bank makes to do those conversions in and out, the more incentivized the consumer will be to keep their, essentially keep their savings in FDIC insured US dollars. I really appreciate that point. Jessica, I have taken up so much of your time. I appreciate this. You have really clarified some of these points where I've read these rules and they make my head spin, right? So I really appreciate the clarity and the framework you have brought to talking through some big, big issues facing bankers right now. Do you have any final words of wisdom, advice, encouragement for banks as they are navigating these waters right now?
I would say that you don't have to love crypto to see the value in some of this stuff. Yep. And we have to, the future is coming, right? For all yep. of us. As yep. And just like I finally got used to using P2P apps, mm-hmm. eventually we're going to get used to doing this. And the faster mm-hmm. we do it, the more ahead of the curve we're going to be, and the more we're going to be able to see the opportunities that might exist mm-hmm. for banks to improve and expand the services that they're mm-hmm. providing to their customers.
I appreciate that. And I think that is a really positive spin to put on a topic that may be making some bankers a little bit nervous. Some are very excited to step into 21st century banking, and some are feeling a little bit of trepidation. So I appreciate that encouragement to our listeners. I do want to put in a pitch, because Jessica, you and I both work for Compliance Alliance. For any bankers that have questions and our members, we are here to help. Reach out to us on the hotline. Jessica is available for educational presentations. And we love talking about this stuff and helping bankers navigate these waters. Jessica, thank you so much for your time. It is truly a pleasure when I get to talk with you and learn from you. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I'm Elizabeth Holtrup, and this has been an episode of Banking Matters.